Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. This is Liberty on the Air. I'm your host, Dan Fishman. To join the conversation with us, the number is 617-266-6868. You can send us a tweet to @libertyontheair.com or join into the Facebook live stream. We got a pretty good audience, 15 people watching already, and more going to be joining in any second. So that's definitely the best way to reach us. There's a minute delay on the Facebook live stream, but you know, you get to see my lovely mug. I'm smiling at you right now, Facebook. So we are back in the studio. Ken Van Tassel joining us again.
I'm sorry, were you trying to convince people to watch the live stream or not?
Well, I'm hoping.
Because they have to see your face.
Exactly. I mean, we had some complaints last time that the microphone was in the way. I moved the microphone to the side, so more face. We may get some questions, some requests to put the microphone back in front. But regardless, we're going to stick with what
we have. Well, that's interesting, because if the microphone's there, they might be able to hear you. But if you move it, they can see you but not hear you. Yeah. So maybe they just didn't want to hear you.
I mean, the number one priority of live radio is always to see the face of the guy behind the microphone.
Exactly. Well, I've been told.
Audio, well, you know, who cares?
I've been told that I have a face for radio. So yes. Here we are.
I'm glad I'm back. I'm glad I can make it back.
Ken, thanks for coming back. I'm in the studio. Matt McLaughlin's here as well. And
good evening.
John Gabzo rocking the producer's booth as usual.
Hello, hello.
So, you know, I was thinking the other day about a conversation that we were having the week beforehand about liberty being sort of, we have this idea that you own yourself. And when we talk about liberty and owning yourself, we flow a lot of the conclusions of liberty around that. The liberty position on cannabis isn't so much that we are in favor of cannabis, but we believe that because you own yourself, you can put anything you want to into your body. The liberty position on, you know, being against an income tax, it's not that we don't want all sorts of great things to happen in our society, but we believe that you own yourself, and so therefore you have a preemptive right to all the product of your labor. Nobody else should have that. And in a conversation I was having over the course of the week, somebody said, you know, that sounds very heartless, because if you say that you don't want for there to be an income tax, if you don't want there to be taxes, you're essentially saying you don't want good schools, you don't want good libraries, and of course, you don't want roads.
I think that's a leap in logic there.
How so?
I think that, I mean, I see where they're going, but to say that you don't want income taxes means like you don't want good schools or whatever. I mean, it's sort of a straw man argument. It's at least a very leading argument. I mean, that doesn't mean that at all. What it means is, and what they're assuming in their argument,
right,
is that those things go to pay for good schools.
It's a very American argument. Because we've been conditioned over the last 100 years, right, since the 16th Amendment really was passed and income tax was brought online. Since then, we have become conditioned to believe that the way that we have to pay for everything is through taxation and through taxes that are collected by the government, you know, in a forceful manner.
Which, to an extent, is fine, you know. I mean, but just because there are no taxes doesn't mean there can't be any schools. Or they're also assuming, by saying that, aren't they also assuming that the schools that we have or the things that we have are good?
Yes, they are.
I think there's a lot of, I mean, there's a lot of leaps.
Well, I mean,
they're getting angry.
They should just be voluntarily crowdfunded, right?
Well, that's where most libertarians would go with that argument. Most liberty-based people, most people who believe in a minimal government, would make the argument that the government forcing you to do it doesn't make it a charitable function at all. In fact, it's a forceful. It is somebody legislating their iteration of morality. It is morality based on the whims of the current majority. And that's
which is
not
a great T-shirt.
Yeah, it's not exactly. It's not a good way to run a railroad, though, because the majority changes. And, you know, everybody who's fearful of what the Trump majority represents now but loved the Obama majority, you're very hypocritical.
Or because, vice versa.
Exactly. Yeah, no, that, yeah.
I mean, it's all tyranny.
Right, exactly. An authoritarian government has authority. Either you like it or you don't. If you like the idea that an authoritarian government can tell people what to do, you have to accept the consequences that when you're not in the majority, the authoritarian government still has all the power that you vested it.
So you're saying democracy is bad, right?
Well, the problem with the democracy, right, and Alexis de Tocqueville talked about this in his famous book, Democracy in America, is that there is a possibility of tyranny by the majority.
Not a possibility, a guarantee.
Well, a guarantee unless you have guaranteed of certain rights that are meant to be majority proof. For example, your right to bear arms is not meant to be subject to the whim of the majority.
Well, it is, especially in Massachusetts.
Well,
I mean, I was thinking about this when I was driving in, actually.
Okay.
I was thinking, you know, in a district that I lived in that had 4,000 Republican voters and 11,000 Democratic voters for state rep every year, you know, every non-presidential year, those 4,000 Republicans just get no representation of their ideas.
Right.
And it goes the same for Republican districts that have Democrat voters. So how is this direct democracy way of electing representatives even incrementally better than, I don't know, any other alternative?
I don't know. I mean, we don't actually – I don't think we actually live in a direct democracy. We live in a
– Well, we directly elect our representatives, right?
At least at the state, at the state level, right. Yeah. And it's an interesting point. I mean
– Well, what's the alternative? Let's throw that – I mean you started with a direction and a leading sort of response. So I'm curious what your if we don't have a direct democracy, what do you think would improve on that?
Well, the argument is that
– Autonomous human beings.
Yeah, government fundamentally – with its ability to infringe upon your liberties.
So no government?
No, a government whose sole job is to protect those people against others who would infringe on their rights.
So how is this government empowered? How do we have representatives?
Through a founding document of sorts.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the
so no, but I mean, like, but I mean, when you talk about the representatives, I mean, you're saying that a government shouldn't have representatives then?
The argument would be that
no, why not?
I'm actually really confused.
Yeah. I mean, I'm saying no. I mean,
you're talking about the votes that those people had.
Yeah, there's no need for state legislatures. There's no need for state laws or federal laws.
Yeah,
made by individuals. A founding document that defines
the guarantees your rights
that exists.
I don't know that it necessarily covers every possible instance. Because
our current system doesn't cover every possible instance. I think that's an argument against changing things because it doesn't cover. That's like the biggest argument against we can't vote for libertarians because they haven't figured out how to make sure there's no homeless people. Have Democrats or Republicans figured out how to have no homeless people?
Not at all. No.
So that argument really, you know, bothers me.
I don't even know those arguments.
Right, but
it's a very popular one.
If you're going to the idea that you don't want state representatives because you don't essentially want a governmental body.
Or a stronger constitution.
Yeah, that's it. A stronger constitution. And, you know, in Massachusetts, we are blessed with the longest continually used constitution. The Massachusetts Constitution was written by John Adams. It predates the American Constitution. In fact, it was the model for the U.S. Constitution.
A scale model?
It was a scale model. They put more stuff in it.
It was an N scale, if you know what that means.
I don't know what N scale means, but...
When you get into model trains, you'll
figure it out. All right, fair enough. So,
I like the idea that at some point he is going to get into model trains.
Well,
we all know that's an inevitability.
I was a Lionel train guy in my youth.
Then you should know what the scale is.
Yeah,
O scale, exactly right.
I think there's nothing particularly wrong with a representative democracy.
Yeah, I think we've stumbled into a larger conversation
you look at
it
the
should
mass
be
statehouse.
Less gerrymandering, and it should be staffed by people who understand the restrictions of this, or it should be a small government.
So more margin things that people talk about is that New Hampshire, which has a population of 12, has 440.
Wait. 11 now, sorry.
Oh, it's only moved out?
Yeah.
Okay, but 440.
You're not counting the cows?
440 representatives. So there is one.
Very small districts?
Right. It's very small districts. There is one representative for every 7,000 people in New Hampshire. And as a result, they're actually, I believe they're the third largest Democratic legislative body after the United States Congress.
Wasn't the U.S. House of Representatives supposed to grow?
It was originally. So originally, it was set up to be one representative for every 30,000 people.
Right.
And around 1900, they said, look, it's getting too big. We've got 435 people in here.
But should they have done that? Should they have passed that?
It's a fascinating question. And I have talked about this beforehand. Now you run it around 770,000 people per representative. But actually, there's a big difference because based on the size of the state, a state can have at least one representative and at most however many. But for example, if you live in, I think it's Wyoming is the least populous state, there's 500,000 people. So you actually get more representation if you live in Wyoming, where you have one representative for 500,000 people, than if you were to live in New Hampshire, where you have two representatives for 2 million people.
But I mean, John mentioned...
Yeah, but that's a feature, not a bug.
I mean, John mentioned gerrymandering, and the Supreme Court's going to hear some gerrymandering cases. But gerrymandering is clearly not the problem in Massachusetts, why other parties other than Democrats don't have power. I mean, arguably, gerrymandering could be the only thing that could save some Republican districts.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. So there is actually a proposal, a candidate who's running for state senate, Walter Zubrio, who has a new proposal for redistricting, where every city gets one state senator no matter what. And then based on your population size, if you don't qualify to be a city, you have to combine with another city, and that's how you get your representative. Some idea that would be better than this geographical drawing of lines that certainly has been thwarting democracy.
Well, I mean, we're in the 21st century. There's not necessarily a reason for districts to be defined geography. Why couldn't voters be assigned a random number that corresponds to their district?
Well,
and make it truly random.
But there are geographical issues around politics.
Yeah.
Right?
All right. I mean, that's fair.
Yeah. Exactly. I think that.
But I mean, using some sort of algorithmic way doesn't put any kind of, you know.
I disagree with that. I think there's. Element. I mean, there is a thing to neighborhoods, to neighbors, to people who live near each other who actually should see each other on a day to day basis. And then the interests you have. I mean, the idea that. If I want to, you know, if I want to live in a town that, you know, doesn't want to have plastic bags,
right?
Then we'll you know,
last week,
you know, and you know, but also if I want to live in a town that has plastic bags, you move. That people comes, have interests.
That comes back to the idea of what I was talking about. You know, this idea of sort of compassionate, and I'll go ahead and take the phrase, the older phrase, compassionate conservatism. But the idea that a group of people living together may have a desire to do good in their community, to have a good and prosperous community. I mean, Matt, I know the area where you grew up in Marshfield. You know, there was an active charitable force there. You talked about growing up, and you know, there's a lot of different things that went on. Beverly has people do a lot of stuff to make Beverly a nice town. They do it voluntarily too. It's not a they're not coerced.
And
to
I
do
think
it.
We should be. Trying to foster that sort of stuff. I think it's one of the things we've sort of lost. And I, granted, it's sort of things change. I mean, I've lived in Southie for about 20 years, and I know Southie was, and we got Skippy's going to be on the line in a second. I know he's called in, so Skippy, I'd like to hear some of your thoughts on this. But Skippy's been there a lot longer than I have, and you know, it's not a place where I know all my neighbors. There's been a bunch of new people moving in,
right.
And I didn't grow up there. My grandfather was born and raised there, but I moved in. And the neighborhood has changed a lot. But one of my favorite things about the giant snowstorms we had a couple years ago, which were a pain in the tuchus, is we were all out shoveling snow. And it was one of the few times I get to see and talk to see my neighbors. And like people, we were actually helping each other. We were being a bunch of, like no one was complaining. No one was, because we were all miserable together. And it was actually sort of a neighborhood unifying thing.
Right.
And it was actually kind of nice.
Yeah, well, and that's it. And that's it. I'm going to follow back on that. The idea that having a neighborhood, having people bonded together actually does encourage a level of compassion towards each other. And when we try to abstract that away, we sort of destroy everything that's been good about the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Speaking of neighborhood, we got Skippy on the line.
Southie, stand up.
Skippy, what do you know?
Hello, gentlemen. Listen, Matt. You said your grandfather was from Southie, so therefore you're a grandfather and you're one of us.
Thank you, Skippy. I appreciate that.
No one's going to slash your tires, all right? So you're okay. But and Dan, you said this stuff about our face for radio. You know, there was a guy on the Gong Show called The Unknown Comics.
Oh, yeah.
He used to wear a paper bag over his head, so you might, you know, that's an option. But
there may be a bag in the studio.
But, you know, you mentioned the word liberty and taxes, and I'll tell you, I don't mind paying taxes as long as it's oversight. You know what I mean? And so that word liberty, it seems like it's like one of those rooms where the walls just keep moving in on it. as far as I'm concerned, especially what's going on up in Washington now with the revelations, what's going on with the deep state.
Yep.
We here on the local, normal level, we believe in the whole thing about liberty and the flag and all that. But up there, it's a whole different deal. So liberty is just, that's just for the peasants.
Exactly. Liberty is almost the opposite of what professional politicians believe that people should have, right? Because they believe they should be guiding our economy.
That's right, but they can. They're only in existence because of the money, because they don't do it for free. So we're paying them. Not they shouldn't. We shouldn't be paying them to set us up. I don't mind. Like I said, the tax. And now liberty. I know you have to have some, barrier. My idea of liberty could be different from yours.
Right.
But that's why we have a republic. You have to have stop signs at an intersection because my other guys said there shouldn't be anything. Then you have chaos and crashes. So, but it's getting so that people are now, even though I think with Donald Trump in there, they're going to blame him, but I think it's a good thing that all this stuff is coming out.
What?
And I think it's going to make room for, like you guys, for a third party. I think it's time to make a move.
I completely agree with you, Skippy, and thank you very much for the call. One of the things that has kept us in sort of this trap of the two-party system so far is that each party plays against the other. And in particular, one of the things that the Democrats have used for a long time is the idea that everybody besides the Democrats are heartless. This goes back to what we were talking about beforehand of the idea that if you don't support their system, you're against having good schools, you're against having roads, you're against having libraries, all sorts of things, health care, all these things that are compassionate. Now, it's not the first time that we've sort of identified this as an issue. The phrase compassionate conservatism is actually quite old. A presidential advisor to Ronald Reagan, Doug Weed, used the phrase compassionate conservatism in a speech in 1979. And the phrase caught on like wildfire. This is, before viral capacity, before the internet, people had 6-track tapes of this speech that they would duplicate.
6-track?
6-track, yeah. Well, the cassette.
2 less?
No, yeah, exactly.
For the 12 or 8-track.
Yeah, but cassette tape is 6-track, sorry. What would commonly be called a cassette tape. I'm not a radio guy.
Isn't a cassette just a stereo track?
Yeah, I think it's just
just 2 tracks.
2 tracks.
On a cassette.
No, I think there's 6 on there. We can count later.
You're going to pull the one you carry around with you everywhere.
Exactly.
So we can check.
All right.
So either way, it's a cassette. So people would duplicate this cassette tape. And he actually went on to define himself as a bleeding heart conservative, saying that, he could care for people. The reason he was a conservative was because he actually believed that the free market was better for poor people. It wasn't just better for rich people. It provided people with more opportunity, no matter who you were. And that the reason he supported the free market wasn't so that he could become wealthy, but so that everybody could become wealthy. And that's a good idea. We generally talk about the free market, and we believe that it provides people with opportunities.
But, it shows you just how well the Democrats are doing at shaping the idea of conservatism as not compassionate, because Reagan had to go on a defensive.
Right, exactly.
By saying, no, here's this thing called compassionate conservatism. That's how cornered,
right? Well,
non-left thinking.
Right, it's gone on. And the phrase compassionate conservatism, Republicans have tried to use it for a while. George Bush, specifically when he ran against Al Gore in 2000, talked about, he says, I want to practice compassionate conservatism. This idea that, we are bringing conservative values, not because we want to restrict access for the poor, but because we want to open access.
I think nowadays that when you're seeing like so many Republicans take a hard line on immigration, that's playing to a lot of people as not compassionate. So, right. There's an opening there for libertarians to be considered if they are considered on the conservative wing, the more compassionate cousin of that idea, though.
Well, and that's
but I don't know. I mean, point. I think that's a good example of just because someone doesn't agree with you, you think they're not compassionate. I don't understand why wanting to follow the law or improve a law to let other people have access to something, why that is not compassionate.
Well,
I think you're you're very closely defining and like almost, you know, defining something in your own way. And then if someone disagrees with it, you get to call them something else, which I don't, which I think is, you know, the sort of the big problem with our politics.
That's the point. Is that that's the key of the conversations that we're having right now, is that the conversations are all about hitting somebody in the feels. How do I make you feel bad about your politics? How do I make you seem heartless?
Dan, you didn't let me finish, and I think what you're saying is totally wrong and trying to make me feel bad.
Exactly right. My goal is that Matt will cry by the end of the show.
Oh, stay tuned, folks. There's another half hour left.
So
we won't have to wait that long.
I just use immigration as a touch point, though, just as an example, because libertarians have more of a sliding scale on that issue. Some are open borders, like myself. Some are a little, you know, they want more border protections. So there's a sliding scale in libertarianism where Republicans nowadays very hard line on that.
Well, but so one of the interesting things about it is that if you are in favor of liberty for people, right? Liberty, freedom means that people are given the freedom to fail. And that's different from the type of government that's being proposed by the other parties. Because the other parties, when they talk about a safety net, right? The idea of the safety net is that we're going to make sure that you don't have to worry about failing, that you don't have to worry about consequences. And, you know, when people raise children, and now that I think about it, nobody in this room has raised a child, but... three of us were children at one point in time in our lives. And, you know, you're growing up with a child, your parents give you an opportunity to fail because you learn something from the process of failing. And that's critical to the evolution as a human being, to understanding that there are consequences to my action. If you fail to, plan, you plan to fail.
And oh, so I thought I knew that.
You learn that as a child. You learn that there's importance.
So you like the Pittsburgh Steelers, for example.
Yes, or the Philadelphia Eagles.
Well, we haven't gotten there yet. Come on.
Yeah, let's not do that.
We're teasing our Super Bowl conversation.
The Steelers were the ones
real
that were looking
ahead.
Real
hot button issues.
Yeah. Exactly.
I think, I mean, here's the thing. I understand the idea of wanting to, you know, safety nets, they're great. You know, the idea of wanting to take care of people is wonderful. It's what we should be doing.
Right.
And I do sort of agree with you. I do think that I think there's a lot of policies this country has that in their efforts to be very helpful to people have ended up being probably detrimental, that have not gotten people out of poor situations that they're in, or poor economic situations, or poor health situations, or what have you. I think we're trying to do something, and I don't think there's malicious intent there. I think there might be some sort of voter intent. They want to keep voters.
Right.
But I don't think there's like some big cabal that's doing that. But I do think that, you know,
well,
I do want to help people, but in the same, but I think you are right. We you know, people have to have the choice, have the ability to fail, and then improve.
It raises a fascinating question, because I want to talk about two of the sort of typical stereotypes. Okay, on the one hand,
is this a 6-track stereotype or an 8-track?
Well, it's funny because there's a musical component to this stereotype. Do you remember the old story of the sort of the company store? All right. So back in the day, in the mining towns, the mines would set up these houses, these sort of neighborhoods that people could come into. You wanted to come in and work, and they would give you $5. They'd loan you, say, okay, we're going to loan you $5, which is your first week's rent on this shack, and $5, which gets you 10 pounds of rice, 10 pounds of beer. And in fact, Tennessee Ernie Ford wrote a wonderful song about that called 16 Tons. We'll play a quick clip from that.
People say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load the 16 tons. What do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter,
deeper
don't
in
call debt. Me cause I can't.
That's essentially
go
where we're going with it. There's a idea that they... corporation would set up a situation in which you would sort of be perpetually indebted to them. And, you know, that's the worst stereotype of what the left will say about the right, is that we have this situation where corporations are creating this world of perpetual debt. Like right now, a new iPhone, I believe, is $1,000. Most people don't pay $1,000 to get their phone. They start paying $30 more a month on their phone bill. but they're accumulating this debt and they keep buying it. And this is endless mountain of debt that sort of is a trap upon your freedom. On the other side of it, right? You know, if the Democrats as a political party, they depend on having a block of voters who depend on, depend on the government. And so if you have this-
if those people weren't in debt or weren't-
Exactly.
If the situation improved-
Right.
They wouldn't be indebted to-
Right. And so something that we're going to think about over the break is whether or not the stereotypes of the right and the left, of the way people are being trapped by either government or anything like that, are true situations or in reality, they're both symptomatic of an absence of liberty. Liberty on the air, 617-266-6868, WRKO, the voice of Boston. We got Mike on the line. Michael calling in from Eastie. What do you know, Mike?
Daniel, how are you? It's Michael O'Malley.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for calling in.
Hey, how are you?
Good, good, good. What's on your mind?
Excellent, excellent topic tonight. All right. I think about this so much, especially as someone who, economically, I've been in a place before where, I'm someone in a recovery. I've been addicted to drugs. I've had absolutely no money. And I'm hearing, you had referenced a minute ago, I think it was a gentleman that you played just before the mining song, where you said that the free market actually helped poor people out because it granted them more opportunity, right?
Yep.
Which I completely agree on, and I'm a prime example of how you can actually utilize the free market despite a quarry, despite all these things that might negatively affect you in order to get ahead in life. I've utilized the free market completely. With that being said, too, I fear a lot right now that people in my generation, specifically the millennial generation, are really selling minorities on the idea of this socialism and how that's what's going to be the best for them. This is the real opportunity for you. And
yeah.
Yet again, I hear another generation where I hear, where basically I hear a white majority tell a minority what is the best for it. And I just think it's a lie. Yet again, we're just telling minorities that, like, all right, we don't believe that you should. We don't want to push for entrepreneurship and business ownership, for instance, which is what we should be promoting.
Let me play a little bit of the devil's advocate here. If you are, you hear Bill Gates is worth $38 billion, and that's in his retirement. Jeff Bezos just became the richest man in the world. It's worth $80 billion. I mean, that's so much money. It's incomprehensible, right? I mean, $80 billion is an amazing amount. Could you make an argument that, maybe there should be some redistribution of that?
No.
All right. I agree with you.
I can make an argument for it.
Sure, right. Sure. I mean,
I want it.
Sure.
And that's the government's argument.
That is the government's argument as well.
But yet again, it's a white majority, especially up here where it's a white majority, telling minorities yet again that, for generations, you haven't had the right for business ownership, right? Come on, let's be honest about this. Like, if you're an African-American in America, the ability to truly own a business without bias and all these things associated with it before you actually owned it. This is really, we're finally coming into the first real time where that's real now. And here we go immediately and we're watching socialism. We're promoting the idea of what's best for the gander instead of the goose. And we know that that's not just the case yet again, and not to mention it's thievery of people's pockets. And there we go again.
Right. No, I completely understand what you're saying there. And thanks very much for the call, Mike. I mean, there's no question that the one philosophy that stands in stark contrast to socialism, socialism is, there's social welfare. Okay. Social welfare is one thing. And there's socialism. Socialism fundamentally means, to most economists, socialism means one thing. The government owning the means of production. So that every possible way of making anything.
Unless it's Venezuela. That was totally not
Venezuelan socialism. And yeah, but I mean, like, you can certainly look at, you know, probably one of the most famous examples of socialism. You know, there's Russian socialism, there's German socialism, the national socialism that becomes the Nazi Party. But they all involve around the government fundamentally controlling the economy with the idea the government is doing it to the benefit of the people. So that there's jobs
and all
for
those
everybody.
All those examples, I mean, they did work for the people, right?
Well, I mean, they're all going strong right now, right? I believe.
Yeah, fundamentally, right. Because to make those things happen, you have to suppress people's liberty, and that's the problem. That's always the problem. Is that there are always
you have to make it a crime.
Exactly right.
To be an entrepreneur,
right? And that's the thing about it is that it means that all the people who want to improve their lot, who want to work harder so that they can make more money, so they can become unequal, they are the enemies of socialism.
I think go ahead.
I was going to say liberty and equality are on a balance scale. And the more equal you want to make everybody, which is somewhat the goal of socialism, the less liberty that people have. And in order to make people equal, you have to take away their liberty. Because otherwise, there's always some hardworking Thomas Alva Edison out there. There's always some Bill Gates. There's always somebody who's going to put in these crazy hours because they want to work hard, because they want to reap the fruit of their labor.
Right. There's the myth that inequality is a problem.
Right.
Because who is Jeff Bezos hurting by staying up late and building Amazon.com?
Right. Nobody. In fact, he benefits so many people.
Because there's the fallacy of the idea of this this economy being a pie that is a fixed size, and that if Jeff Bezos is taking larger and larger slices,
right,
then there's less left over.
Right.
When the reality is that Jeff Bezos is baking new pies every day.
Well, the analogy I always like is people have the phrase, they say, a rising tide lifts all boats.
Yeah.
So we got Justin on the line from Boston. Justin, you're calling in. I see you got jury duty, huh?
Yeah. I was called for. I was like summoned for jury duty, which I didn't think was possible. But like our research, so Massachusetts, as like you know, is like
because you're a college student here, right, from out of state?
Yeah. Because I spend like more than 6 months here. So I guess like my question for you would be. When I was like researching more about the like juries and jury duty, so on the one hand, like the Fifth and Sixth Amendment says that you have like a positive right, which is like unusual for the Constitution to say that, but you have a positive right to a trial by jury. But on the other hand, like the 13th Amendment says like you can't be forced to do something,
right?
Like you can't be forced to like be on a jury if you don't want to. Like you're threatened with jail time.
No, I understand exactly what you're saying. It is it's an absolute contradiction, because you're right. Yeah. You are compelled to jury duty. The argument that I would make in the government's favor here, and it's not necessarily the greatest argument, but it's the one thing that they compel you to do. We don't have a draft anymore. We did at times have a draft as well.
Well, we have selective service still.
Right, and we have selective service, but it's been a long time since anybody's been forced to go. But you're right.
Well, depending how things go the next few months, who knows?
Right. Well, no, our war with North Korea, it's going to be Rocket Man and I don't
right, but that's an interesting point. Is that the one imperfection in the formation of the United States that is necessary? Because it's built so strongly on the idea of a jury trial system for justice?
It is. I mean, that's essentially it, is that the premise behind what we have is that you have the right to a trial by your peers. You only have that if your peers can give you a trial. And that means that it can't just be...
And jury duty is... I recently had jury duty.
Yep. Me too.
And it's... it is interesting. We look at the sort of the history of it and how it wasn't that long ago that, women weren't allowed, or people who weren't working. But it was also changed.
In Massachusetts, women were not allowed to serve on a jury until like 1950.
But also the other interesting thing is because it used to basically serve on a jury, each state was a little different. But in Massachusetts, you might serve for like 30 days. You might serve on several different juries.
Right.
Now it's one day or one trial, which most states have sort of adopted. But what was happening in Massachusetts, and believe it or not, I mean, this is sort of a thing I think is rampant in government. They started giving exemptions for certain peoples.
Right.
Like if you were like a policeman or a lawyer, like, you know, like, okay, that sort of makes sense.
Right.
But then they started and like they had a judge come down and sort of, you know, tell us some of the story. Like certain classes of people were being exempt from jury duty.
Right.
And some of these people were, of course, sort of connected. Like, and then some of it was like, you know, doctors or nurses, people who couldn't take some of this time off, maybe some fishermen. Like, some of these things made sense, but it got to a point that I'm going to get the name a little wrong, but it was essentially like the Honorable Association of Bell Ringers. Like, yeah. Something to that. That sounds made up, but that was an honest-to-God class of people that was exempt from jury duty for years, and the fact that, like, no one even knew what they did.
Right. I mean, when you make a system like that and you have exemptions, people are going to abuse it, and that's always a problem.
Yeah. So in order to – so you have two choices, exemptions or no exemptions. Like, you have to sort of force people
– Yeah. It's better to have no exemptions. Police officers should serve on the jury at various points in time as well. They're just as adequately trained as everybody else.
Yeah, but how many of those actually don't get dismissed by a judge?
Well, most. I mean,
most people do.
I have never had a. Well, I've never actually had.
I would say 99% of police officers get dismissed.
Well, I would argue that an attorney, right, will be dismissed.
Well, in a criminal, maybe not civil.
Exactly. Yeah. However, the one other thing I want to say about jury duty before we go to our next caller is that Massachusetts has a proud tradition of what's called jury nullification, where the jury can look at the law and say, you know what, the law is unjust, and as a result, we are going to find the defendant innocent. It was most commonly practiced when slaves would escape to Massachusetts, and even though the Dred Scott decision had been passed, which said that runaway slaves were still the property of their owners in the South, therefore they were criminals, in Massachusetts juries, slaves would be brought before the jury and said, these are runaway slaves, we need you to convict them, and the Massachusetts juries would say, oh, not guilty, let them go.
Yeah, I actually kind of implemented jury nullification to get off of a jury once, because the last time I was called to jury duty, the case was about a guy making fake inspection tags for cars.
Yeah.
And for me, it's like, I don't care if a guy does that unless he can directly be drawn to a case of that causing an accident where it was right. A problem. But I don't have a problem with fake tags. It's silly.
One thing that I always tell people is that if you were ever arrested, would you want somebody like you to be on the jury? And if so, then you ought to consider.
Yeah, my question is,
that's iffy.
Do you think the punishment for if you say decided to object and not attend jury duty, do you think they're too harsh in Massachusetts?
I don't actually know what the punishment is.
It's
death.
Up to a $2,000 fine.
Yep.
And then if someone doesn't show up, then the judge can file an arrest warrant for them. And they can be incarcerated.
I think that's a little too harsh, in my opinion. Maybe pull. I would pull voting privileges and a few other things. We got Steve on the line. Steve's calling in from Braintree. What do you know, Steve?
Hey, how are you guys? I just the last caller and your interpretation of the 13th Amendment. That was an amendment that strictly outlawed slavery. It doesn't bind anyone to do anything. It was to outlaw slavery. It's not even in the Bill of Rights, the first 10. It's simply outlawed slavery. So I'm not really sure where that last caller thought that the 13th Amendment had anything to do with a social obligation, a civil obligation to serve on a jury. I mean, that
well, I think the argument would be that, you know, if you are being forced to serve on a jury, if you're being forced to do anything, right?
The text says neither slavery nor involuntary servitude is jury duty.
Exactly
involuntary
right.
servitude could be.
Involuntary servitude is indentured servitude under the meaning. It has absolutely nothing to do with jury duty. I don't know where. I mean, I get you guys are libertarians, and I get it, but I mean to misinterpret the that was to disallow indentured servitude and slavery.
Well,
I agree. He's kind of stretching, to be honest.
The
last
has nothing to do with jury duty or other civil obligations like. You know, if we didn't have a jury system, how would we try people if we didn't require people to serve on a jury? No one would do it. We'd have to have professional juries. It's an obligation. There are things that come with being a member of society. You reap the benefits of a police force and a judiciary that keeps criminals from, you know, we give this stuff up. This is the social contract, right? That's how we got here. If you guys want to live
Nobody consented to it. But nobody consented to it.
Okay, that is the most ridiculous thing. Then go live on an island. And like, what is? How do you
on a different planet?
A social contract. Do you want to defend the country on your own? Do you want to? I get the theory. How did you not consent to be a member of a society somewhere? I mean, this is your great, 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 great ancestors decided it's better not to live like cave people and beat each other about the heads every time we have a dispute. It's better to have a system of laws and government. I don't know how.
Well, so let's go back to the text of the 13th Amendment. When they say no involuntary servitude, what do you think
that
is the intent there?
With government service. It was for indentured servants because that still existed in this country.
So
you can't not pay someone to provide a service to you.
If you were going to pay somebody, that you can force them to do something. The government has the right to do that.
No, it's created a jury system. You have an obligation to serve. If you're a witness, you get a $7 fee. If you you get served a summons, you get a $7 fee. There are things you get paid for when you appear in court, but you don't get paid to be on a jury. I just don't understand how the system would work if you didn't have juries. What would we do?
I think Steve makes an excellent point. I think the caller was making a stretch with the involuntary servitude. I think that's a dishonest sort of look at it, and I think Steve sort of put it on, calling it your civic obligation. You know, not to cut you off, Steve, but I think it is a civic obligation. If we are going to live as a society, and if you didn't make the choice to live here, I mean, at some point you did. You can make the changes, but I think there is a when you live in a neighborhood, when you live in a society, you have. We have an obligation to each other, and if we're not going to, are you forcing someone to do something?
The argument that I was trying to make in the beginning is that I would argue that jury duty, because it's so impressive, and thank you very much for the call, Steve, because jury duty is such a critical part of our system. It probably is the exception that I would say.
Well, I mean, the alternative to forced or threatened penalties for not committing jury duty is to, like we're doing on our show, talk about how important it is. And even if it was voluntary, I might be inclined to do it because I would want some people to do the same for me.
Well, I mean, that's my argument all the time in that, I think that most people, if you want to get out of jury duty, you probably can now in this day and age. I mean, you can go express some pretty strong views. But I always tell people that I think you should. I mean, for me in particular, right, I know that I am an odd duck. And there may be a point in time at which, I've been in trouble in the law for various things, and activism, other issues. And if I were in front of a jury, I would hope that there was somebody like me serving on that jury. And as a result, whenever I get called, I do everything I can to be impaneled, even though I am a strong proponent for jury nullification.
And this state and many states have followed suit to really work with this one day or one trial. That's the government really sort of working to make it easier. And I've actually sat in – I mean, I've never been a juror. But I have sat in criminal trials. I've been in the audience, so to speak, and I've watched the judge, listened to the judge talk. They are very, they very much appreciate what the jury is doing. They're not, and they, I mean, because they know. I mean, both sides, the prosecution and the defense, and the judge know that if they're pissing you guys off, that they're not going to get justice. They want you to have not so much a good time, but they are very appreciative. They legitimately, they do whatever they can to accommodate you, and to.
It's an interesting question because, you think of we go back to sort of our critical words, the foundations of our society, the underpinnings. And one of them is with liberty and justice.
For who?
For all.
Oh, okay.
For everybody.
I missed that part.
Yes. They changed it originally. It just said for the seven people. Yeah. Now, liberty and justice for all. That justice for all and that liberty for all.
It's a great Metallica album.
Requires compromises.
Yes.
Okay, because we can't have liberty for all.
Very good album.
Unfettered, because liberty for all would mean that I could do whatever I wanted, including impose on your liberty.
Yeah, which is a contradiction, because then my liberty, then I don't have
exactly
all
right
of it.
Justice for all requires a system that is broader than just any one person, because one person's definition of justice is not actually justice for everybody. Justice has to be an agreed upon standard.
Liberty and social justice for all, right?
Liberty and social justice for all.
If we're not
and social justice warriors.
If you're that much against,
sometimes.
If you think that sitting on a jury is akin to slavery, then I think
you probably have a very optimistic view of what slavery was like.
No, well, I mean, if you're comparing to the 13th Amendment, if you're saying the 13th Amendment prevents it, then and if you're that much against jury duty or that much against the government forcing you, then I have a question of who do you want to judge you when a crime happens?
Well, that was Steve's point. He said, are we going to have professional juries? And like, I agree that that would be a disaster.
I do agree with that.
Like, that is – I mean, I think it's something that we have to – that you know, called a social contract. But, I mean, when you have a government – I mean, like, my God, if you're looking for liberty, if you're looking for stuff to happen, the one thing you should really love is the idea at the most important points – we're inviting the neighborhood in to make the biggest decision.
Right.
So if you're against juries, then maybe you just don't want any government. I don't know. Yeah. I mean,
go live on your stupid island. Well, defend it like cavemen. I mean, that's what you're saying.
Right. Go and seasteading.
Right.
Well, me.
Well, I do think that the basic idea, I think we probably have a little bit of a consensus that.
I mean, Dan bought his ticket to Somalia. He's leaving right after the show.
Right.
No, he's waiting for after the Super Bowl.
The Libertarian Paradise.
Wait, right. They don't get the Super Bowl in Somalia?
No, that was actually one of the big things about the shutdown, is that Armed Forces Network wasn't going to be able to show the thing. And speaking of which, you know, we should briefly talk about the fact that.
In like a minute.
The Super Bowl is coming up.
Which I'm nervous as heck about.
Do you have a prediction, Matt?
I think the Pats are going to win, but I'm nervous as heck. I don't. I think Philly has a strong defense, and I know Nick Foles is a backup, but they lost their real quarterback how long ago? Seven weeks ago. They kicked butt last week, so Ken, I think.
You have a Super Bowl prediction?
New England 28, Philly 17.
I like it. I think that Nick Foles ends up screwing something up pretty significantly.
Actually, I think the Philadelphia special teams is actually going to be the weakest link of the game.
The Patriots never blow anybody out, except for the Titans this year in the playoffs. But generally, they keep it close to the vest. I also like Patriots to win. I think it's going to be 28-21.
Oh, please, no. I want a good, easy win.
It'll be an easy win.
I want 68-3 is what I want. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but that's what I want.
I want a chasm to open up in the middle of the field, the Eagles team to fall in. All right, maybe I don't want that.
Wasn't that the Batman movie that happened?
Yes. Either way, we hope that you're going to have a wonderful Super Bowl, that you take advantage of your liberty and celebrate it with your friends. And we look forward to hearing you here back next week.
Good night.